The level of confidence Americans expressed in the economy remained near an 18-year high this month, and this apparently suggests steady U.S. growth in the months ahead. Now enter a sharp-edged line graph trending upward and our eyes glaze over. The Conference Board said Tuesday that Consumer Confidence Index rose to 128 from a revised 125.6 in April. Do those numbers leave you feeling empty? We're filling in some gaps on how our economy works, breaking down the lingo here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is Bread and Butter for Patty Hirsch. She is a journalist and online host. He currently edits the Planet Money Indicator at NPR, and he worked in public radio both at NPR and on Marketplace. He's a specialist in business, finance, and economics. His book breaks down the financial system. It's called Man versus Market. It's got a new fiction book about Wall Street. Comes out next week. It's called Devil's Half Mile, and he joins us with the help of NPR West. Patty, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Kate.
So what, we're starting here with consumer confidence trending at an 18-year high. So what the heck is consumer confidence and how is it measured?
Well, consumer confidence is measured in a couple of ways or a couple of organizations that ring up a bunch of consumers and say, hey, how are you feeling about the economy? You're feeling good? You're feeling bad? You want to spend more? You're going to spend more in the next couple of weeks or next couple of months? Or are you going to spend less? Then they crunch those numbers and, spit out a little bit of data for us. And it comes out, pretty much every month. Everybody gets very excited about it. But the fact is that it doesn't actually translate that well into the economy as it stands at the moment, right? Because consumers change their minds. They might tell somebody on the phone one day, oh yeah, I think I will buy that new car, or I think I will go out and buy a new refrigerator. And then, maybe a couple of weeks later they don't actually do that and pull the trigger on that. And you can see the difference in consumer confidence and consumer sentiment, which are two of the ways that these are measured by different organizations, and the actual trajectory of economic growth, which, as we know now, is slightly less than we thought it was going to be. It's now down. They revised GDP growth to 2.2%. So, we're trickling along at about the same rate that we've been trickling along since, the beginning of the second term of the Obama administration. Just kind of bumping along the road there. Certainly not up to the 3% that President Trump vowed that he would reach when he first came into office, when he was elected.
So we love to say the economy is humming along, or it is cooking, or it's juiced, or that it's lagging and struggling. And we look at all these different indicators and trying to figure out who gets the credit for it. Is it the current administration, or is it the former administration, or are these trend lines a long way in coming? Do we have to look past the recession, the Great Recession? So how do we figure this out?
Well, these are long-term trend lines, right? I mean, you're looking at the economy over years of growth and trying to give credit or not where it's due. And of course, as consumers, as individuals who are part of the economy, we would like to give credit to, or maybe we wouldn't like, but a lot of us will give credit to one president or one administration or another. The fact is that the economy has been growing at the rate that it's growing right now since Obama was re-elected for his second term, right? So you could say, in that case, it's all about Obama. And a lot of people on the left will say, yeah, I mean, this is Obama's economy. But, we're now well into the Trump administration, and so you've got to give credit where it's due. Donald Trump, unlike President Obama when he took over at his first administration, took over a nightmare situation with the economy. Trump took over an economy that was ticking along at about 2.2, 2.3%. And it remains that way. And that's great, because this is an economy that is in a world economic situation, which is not that great. This is an economy that's doing pretty well. So we're doing okay. And it's great that we're still doing okay. We may do better in the future. We may do worse. We don't know. But right now, we're doing all right. And so I would say that President Trump should be given credit for that. The economy is still doing as well as it was when he took over. And that's a good thing.
Well, President Trump and Congress celebrated a victory in passing tax cuts early this year. Some called it tax reform, and that turned out to be quite a taboo word for journalists, because it hinted that we were reforming something. So is it unfair to judge the president's economic track record until those have been factored into the economy, those tax cuts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, who knows how those tax cuts are going to pan out? It'll take years for us to really be able to make a call on that. I mean, people are really now only making a call like a serious call on the Bush tax cuts from way back. You know, people are now saying, oh, well, they actually did a lot of damage to the economy. But there's a lot of, again, it depends on where you sit, and it depends on what results you actually would like to see in the economy as to whether or not you think, you know, a tax cut has done a good thing or a bad thing. So it's going to take us a while to actually figure out how well those tax cuts have done and what kind of impact they're going to have on the economy. You certainly can't make those calls overnight. They're going to take years before we really get a sense of how they've actually kicked in.
And we've only seen paychecks really see any type of change since about February. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, some people have seen a little bit of bump in the paycheck, you know. I mean, the numbers are supposedly not that great, but everybody likes to see a little bit more money in their paycheck, even if it's only a relatively insignificant amount. It just makes you feel better. And you have this magnifying effect with money that comes into your paycheck. If you do get a little bit more, makes you feel richer. And that actually probably contributes somewhat to that consumer sentiment number we're talking about. You know, people
Did
are
you just
a little
come
bit
full
more
circle,
flush.
Patty? Yeah.
Wow, look at that. You can tie the bow.
So what is the difference between the national debt and the federal deficit?
The national debt and the federal deficit. Well, you know, we're talking about, when people talk about the Fed's balance sheet, right, they're talking mm-hmm. about the amount of money, right, that the Fed, that the country is borrowing. You know, so people talk about that, the amount of money that we've got in the amount of money that the amount of bonds that we've got that we've sold to other people, right? Or so a lot of people get those two things confused, right? They're not necessarily exactly the same thing. People talk about that number that's been ticking around in Times Square, that's I think it's what, $16 trillion or more than that right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's moving all the time, so you
and
we can't even
fathom what $16 trillion is. I mean that number just seems implausible.
Yes, it absolutely does seem implausible. And it is in many ways implausible, because in many ways these numbers are almost kind of made up, because the more that the government borrows from around the world, you know, it issues bonds and, you know, people in China or Japan, or even actually the majority of people that buy U.S. Treasury bonds are actually Americans. So we eat a lot of our own cooking, if you like.
Mm.
The money that we borrow, we're always going to be in a situation the way we feel right now, if the economy remains configured the way it is right now, we're always going to be able to sort of roll that over. It's kind of like a credit card debt. We're always going to be able to go back to the bank and borrow that money again and just pay off one credit card with another. And the reason for that is because here in the United States, we print our own money. We're responsible for our own financial situation. So, and we have the largest, banking system in the world to allow us to do that, that is to say the Federal Reserve banking system to do that. So we can just roll over our debt all the time. So we don't really feel like it affects us that much, because it's like, oh, we can always just keep on borrowing. We're not like in Europe, where one European economy, like the Italian economy, for example, can't issue more debt because, you know, it's part of the Eurozone. It's not responsible for that debt. That debt is, you know, controlled in another place. So the Italians don't have that same kind of that same kind of liberty over their own economy. So, you know, we feel this kind of freedom with our balance sheet. Oh, we can just keep on borrowing. It's all going to be fine because we're always going to be able to pay it back. And
but
right
Americans
now, that's
like
the case.
Freedom. They really like that, don't they?
We love that freedom, of course. And it's great for us. It's great for us because it makes everything so flexible for us. But it means we are actually able. You know, we can actually do this. This is a real thing. We can actually keep on borrowing at the moment. Now, that situation may end. Who knows? If people decide they don't like the look of the American economy so much, if they decide that, you know, it is riskier to, it's actually not so safe to borrow that American debt, to buy that American debt rather, then guess what? It's going to be much less easy for us to borrow. It's going to be much more expensive. And then we're going to run into trouble. But right now, things look pretty sunny, so we can keep on borrowing. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, President Trump feels he can actually put these tax cuts in place, because he can always borrow into the future. And, you know, these deficits that everybody was so worried about 5 years ago, nobody seems to be worried about at all anymore.
Patty Hirsch is with us. He edits the Planet Money Indicator at NPR. He's worked in public radio both at NPR and on Marketplace, author of Man Versus Markets. You can call in with your anything goes questions about economics. He'll tackle it, 800-642-1234. Do you tune out when someone says economics? What intimidates you about understanding finance? Do you comprehend how to run a business, but not how that all fits into a greater world? world system. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Anne, who is waiting in Green Bay. Hi, Anne.
Hello. You were just talking about the tax reform from the Trump administration, which I think is going to come back to bite us down the road, because I wish they would have kept that money and put it into an infrastructure rebuilding and more education and more social programs, and not taken and, you know, use this money to basically buy votes.
Well, Anne, thanks so much for the call. Patty, there are trade-offs here when you bring those tax cuts.
There absolutely are trade-offs, and Anne's absolutely right. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who would agree with her and say, you know, they should not be just, you know, giving this money back to people who have already got plenty of money. We should actually, and a lot of people would say, well, a lot of those people who got that money don't have plenty of money. But there is a degree of truth to what she says. You know, you're taking money from one part of the economy and shifting it into another. So she makes the point that she would like to see a larger infrastructure spend, for example. Well, you know, the Trump administration would argue, and it could argue correctly in this case, that it can actually borrow against that and do that infrastructure spending with money that it's going to borrow in the future. Now, that, of course, that could go either way, because if the economy does really, really well, which is what the bet is, you're going to start to see more tax revenue coming in, and then they should be able to pay. The theory is that you take that tax revenue and you'd use that to offset the money that you've kind of basically borrowed in order to maybe put that infrastructure spending plan in place. And the idea, of course, is if you have a big infrastructure spending plan, then more people are going to be employed, more people are going to be paying taxes, so you get the offset there. So that's what the theory is, and maybe that'll work. We'll have to see.
That's like also an injection in the economy.
There's an injection in the economy, but it is a gamble. It is a gamble because, you know, maybe you don't get, maybe people decide not to spend that money, for example. Maybe they just decide to start saving it, which would be a real a miracle for American consumers. Maybe we did start to save it, so we didn't spend it so much, so you didn't see the trickle through the economy that you would hope. Sure, you may get better income tax revenues from that money, which would help to some extent, but you know, the fact is that it may not, and this may well turn out to come and bite us. And a lot of people are saying that it will, but of course a lot of people are making a bet on the other side. So yes, this whole thing is a gamble, but it's a gamble that's based on, once again, this ability of the American government to borrow as much as it wants in perpetuity for as long as it wants, and that I think is an even bigger gamble.
Let's go to Rick now in Park Falls with thoughts. Rick, hi.
Good morning. I would just like to mention that I think it's widely acknowledged that the Great Recession of 2008 was caused by a combination of a massive government regulatory incompetence, not only by the Federal Reserve, which is supposed to regulate banks, but by the different regulatory bodies in all 50 of the states that are all supposed to regulate banks. Combination with enormous criminality in these crooked loans that were given out by so many of the banks, the too big to fail banks. I mean, names like Lloyd Blankfein, the head of AIG, and Jeremy Dimon, the head of Citigroup, the man that recklessly lost $6 billion for his bank investors. The Federal Reserve dangerously reduced the reserve requirements for these big banks on Wall Street like Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns, and that meant that they had no money left over to cover bad debts,
and Rick, they all went under. Rick, I'm going to pause you right there. And, you know, Patty, it has been a decade now, and people are still thinking about the Great Recession, what happened. How do you begin to explain what happened and where we are today?
Well, you know, Rick asks a very interesting question. Well, he didn't actually ask this question, but I think he would agree with me that this is behind the point that he's making, which is, you know, however many years on we are now, almost a dozen years on, nobody's gone to jail, right? We just had this 10-year anniversary, and nobody, after all of this incredible cataclysm where we lost so much money, and there clearly was, you know, rampant kind of corruption, or certainly, you know, corruption around the fringes of the financial circumstance that we were in, criminality. It's a strong word, but I don't think he's entirely wrong. But nobody has gone to jail. There's been no kind of reckoning. And yet here we are 10 years on, and we're starting to dismantle the regulatory system that was put in, the Dodd-Frank Act put in after the financial collapse. So, you know, Rick is arguing for more regulation, and there are a lot of people who do argue for more regulation, but here we are dismantling the regulation that we'd put in place. I actually think that what we're looking at is we are looking at a significant financial restructuring, or a restructuring of the financial markets. But in many ways, that's a good thing, because if you have too much regulation, you know, I'm not a huge fan of over-regulation, because if you have too much regulation and you have one regulatory system laid on top of another and it becomes too complicated, then you've got like a spider web effect where you've got all these holes and these gaps where people can, these bankers are smart people. You know, they're paid to find a way through these holes in order to maximize profits for their shareholders. That's what they do. So the more complicated the system is, actually, I think the more dangerous it is. So what we're looking at now is a stripping back of the system. In many ways, that's a good thing. I mean, I think there's maybe some overreach here and there. But what we're looking for, I hope, is a simpler regulatory system that has good, strong rules and solid boundaries that are going to keep bankers whose job is, once, as I say, to maximize shareholder value, to keep them in check, to make sure that they're not overstepping and actually discriminating against consumers. Or, I mean, we talked about, I think Rick mentioned, you know, sales of, you know, bad mortgages to people, to doing underhand things like that. So I'm hoping that that's where we're going to come out. That's where we're going to settle out. But I think that, you know, we are in this interesting situation where we're watching the dismantling of a regulatory system to some extent. And a good example of that was this, the Volcker rule, which we can talk about if you want to, that the news of that came out just the other day.
And we will be getting to the Volcker rule. Patty Hirsch stays with us. He's a journalist, online host, editing the Planet Money Indicator at NPR. He's worked in public radio, both at NPR and on Marketplace, author of Man Versus Markets. You can call in with your questions about the financial systems that are amongst us. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. As Patty Hirsch was saying, the Federal Reserve yesterday proposed changes to the Volcker rule. That's a regulation that helps prevent another bank bailout, like the ones during the financial crisis that we've been talking about. So from Volcker rule to Dodd-Frank Act, lots of policy regulations impacting our day-to-day economy. We're breaking down the big economic principles, trying to understand them, making sense how they apply to our life when we open our wallets. Our economics wingman is Patty Hirsch. She's author of Man Versus Markets. You can jump in with your questions about the economic forces that perplex you at 800-642-1234. What's your question about banking systems or bailouts? Do you know what private equity means, or questions about what commodities are? Did you study economics? What drew you to the field? Call in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Patty, how does the Volcker Rule and Dodd-Frank Act, how does that all impact our lives and impact what's going on in the banking system today?
Well, before we get into the Volcker Rule, which is, don't get me wrong, I'm very excited about the Volcker Rule and everything about it. But let's start off by getting a little perspective about the Dodd-Frank Act, okay, which is, of which the Volcker Rule is part.
We're
in 2010. Uh-huh. Congress puts together this massive piece of legislation called the Dodd-Frank Act, which is supposed to erase any chance of us ever falling into the situation that we were, you know, in 2006, 2007, where we created this financial crisis that hit us in 2008. All right, this is the whole point. That's why we create this piece of legislation. This piece of legislation was 2,300 pages long.
Oh, some light reading.
Massive. Mm-hmm. Some light reading, exactly. It was way bigger than anyone ever really wanted it to be. And that's because, of course, as we know, when politicians get together and they want to put a piece of legislation together, they stuff all these earmarks into it. It's like, you know, they take the shopping bag and they shove everything into it. So they've walked out of, everyone's got like a little prize when they walk out of the store. And that's the situation that we had. And of course, that is massive regulatory overreach. Okay, it's hugely disruptive to the system. It was way, way bigger than it needed to be. And it actually caused, in many cases, more problems than it solved. I would not necessarily say that the Volcker rule could fall into that category, but there's no doubt. I mean, even Paul Volcker himself, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, who was kind of the architect or at least the inspiration for this rule, even he himself said, you know, by the time it was done, it was probably too inflated. It was probably too sort of bloviated. It was probably too big and fat and actually didn't do really what it was supposed to do.
Oh, so he had some 2020 hindsight there as well.
Absolutely.
In his own world. Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, when the news came out yesterday that this was actually going to be changed, he looked at the actual changes that are going to be made to this rule. And the rule is not being revoked, by the way. It's being changed. It's being stripped out a little bit. He actually looked at it and said, meh, that seems fair enough to me. I mean, you know, it's been rolled back a little bit, but it still has the spirit of what it is that he wanted to do. So what is it that he wanted it to do? Well, the Volcker rule was put in place because banks were indulging in something called proprietary trading. So when you think about the business of a bank, you're thinking about, you know, savings and loans, right? You know, taking money in from consumers, lending it out at slightly more money and making money that way. That's the traditional method of how banks made money. That's how retail banks made money. Now, investment banks make money by doing much more risky things, right? You know, they're the people who originally would, underwrite or, you know, give money to some trader who would go off and buy a ship and he'd sail it off around the world and he'd come back hopefully with it stuffed with spices and silks and all kinds of stuff. And then they would sell that and a chunk of that money would go back to the investment bank for making that original investment. Right? That was the original merchant banking business. And that is a big gamble, right? You're giving a bunch of money to somebody to go away and do some business, then come back and hopefully give you some of that money back. So investment banks are much more sort of gambly, right? They're much more involved in risky activity in a way that retail banks aren't necessarily. So when you had this merger of these two types of banks, retail and investment banks, it meant that these big banks like Citigroup and JP Morgan and all the rest of it, these people were doing both types of business. So it was okay if you were doing that type of business, that investment type of business, with your own money. But what people worried about was that, firstly, they were taking too much risk with their own money, so that if things went wrong, then they would start to eat into the retail banking money, that's to say our money that we're lending that bank, you know, or putting our bank into its savings accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Or those banks might use our money to make those risky bets, right? So you've got this sort of, I mean, imagine it. You've got the sort of staid picture of a bank out the front, you know, the front of the bank, and people are doing, you know, retail banking business. Everyone's in a suit and a tie. And out the back, you've got them running a casino, right? That's the kind of image that people had, right? So you're worried that the casino business is going to impact the retail banking business. And that was what Paul Volcker wanted to avoid when he put the Volcker rule in place that said banks can't do any of this proprietary trading.
Kind of, right? Some firewalls in place.
Exactly, like a big old firewall. Now, a lot of people are looking at this change, and some people are tearing their hair out, going, "Oh my gosh, you know, we're taking this the Volcker rule to pieces. We're dismantling it. We're going to open the door to all of this type of trading again." You look at the detail, and in actual fact, that's not the case. The provisions that will prevent banks have been changed slightly. I mean, originally it was up to the banks to decide whether or not they were. They would basically have to prove that any trades that they did were not going to impact their other type of business. But in this situation, it's the regulators that decide, and that's just a change in nuance. And it's actually probably a smart thing, because it means then that banks have to do less of the work at the front end. They just go about their business, and the regulators just keep an eye on them. So I think that, you know, saying that this is the end of the Volcker rule is overreach. Paul Volcker himself doesn't even think that. So I think that it's, you know, what we're talking about here is the stripping out of this 2,300-page document, the Dodd-Frank Act, that came to pass in 2010.
Let's bring in Mike now in Madison with a question. Hi, Mike.
Oh, hi. I would be pleased to hear what your guest would have to say about what will happen once the reality and unintended consequences of our fossil fuel burning and paving our landscape, green landscape, start changing the world as it has already in the form of climate change, but it can only get worse and more horrific. What's going to happen to the economy?
So climate change and the economy and the impact that fossil fuels are having on our economies.
Well, that's a great question, Mike. I wish I had a crystal ball in front of me to be able to tell you, but I cannot. Who knows? I mean, who could have guessed today? You know, if you look back to the 1920s when people were putting, you know, sort of laying down highway and saying, you know, we're gonna, and you know, moving us really towards this, you know, highly fuel dependent economy, fossil fuel dependent economy. Who could have guessed that we would be today where we are today back then? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's impossible to say. But I think that the trend over time, it's almost like, you know, two steps forward, one step back in terms of the way that we're looking at the environment. You know, during the Clinton administration, for example, the Obama administration, you have these Democratic administrations that are very, very focused on, you know, making sure the environment is looked after. And then maybe you have a Republican administration that comes in and sort of undoes some of that. But over time, I think that, you know, we are moving into a cleaner world. It may not be a particularly, it's a fairly halting progression, but, you know, we're polluting way less per capita now than we were, say, you know, 20 years ago. You know, so the trend over time, I think, is positive, but I think over the short term, you can start to despair when you think, oh my gosh, we're going to be drilling in the Arctic, or oh my gosh, we're laying down more asphalt, or, you know, why aren't we putting regulatory provisions together that force us to go towards, battery cars or to move away from fossil fuels. I mean, there's a cost issue there, right? If you make a decision like that, it's a huge cost to the economy and to a great extent a huge cost to the individual. And it's understanding why politicians don't want to push people into those areas. But I think that over time, look, you know, the fact is we have electric cars now. We didn't have those 20 years ago. You know, we have hybrids. You know, we've moved into this technology over time because I think that businesses are taking a longer term view than maybe the government is. Not surprising, because businesses don't get re-elected every 2 years, although they do have shareholders. But you're starting to see this move in technology towards those positive, environmental friendly types of technologies, because they see the future better than politicians do. I think that over time politicians will lag, but they'll get there in the end.
Do you see energy production still a real driver of our U.S. economy, or is that fading a little bit?
No, I don't think so. I think it's still going strong. I mean, you know, the world still needs that oil, and even if we need it less, you know, the fact is it's still cheaper for us to pull it out of the ground, even if we're fracking as opposed to pumping, although the two are pretty close to the same thing, I know, without getting into the details, even though it is still way, way more expensive to pull oil out of the ground than it was, say, 20 years ago. It's still more cost effective for us to do that. So I think it's still going to remain a very, very significant part of the economy. Absolutely. Very important.
Let's go to Jim now in Sheboygan. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was on hold for a bit. A quick correction that no one went to jail regarding the mortgage lending fiasco. That is not accurate. Large lenders who purchased, bundled, and sold back to the Fed are in jail and have been now for almost a decade. So there are people that went to jail. Just nobody in government did, because they never do, and nor do they ever get removed. So, in fact, people did go to jail. So that's kind of a broad brush when you say nobody went to jail. Second, as NPR, whether it be Wisconsin or nationally, you seem to work for, that funds you, is kind of the home for socialism and communism. Let's face it. It's kind of the MSNBC of the radio. And the call constantly that you hear on public radio stations is the beating of the drum for communism and socialism. And
so, Jim, what question are you asking?
I'm there now. Thank you. Is the beating of the drum of horrible corporate entities making profit, and corporate profit is awful, horrible, rotten thing. And I'm kind of hoping for a bit of reality from you as an education, a point of education to people as to what happens if there is no corporate profit, what happens to corporate, to private pension funds, public pension funds, grandma eating cat food because her 401k is in the toilet. Where do those corporate profits go to versus where I think a lot of listeners believe that goes to? It isn't sitting in a drawer somewhere. It's dividends, it's its capital. Every time money is moved, that's when it's taxed.
Well, let's let Patty. Yeah, let's let Patty look into corporate profits here and help us get a little explainer on that.
Well, I'm a little confused as to why Jim thinks there aren't any corporate profits. I mean, corporations are massively profitable right now. I mean, look at the state of the stock market. And I know that the stock market is a bet really on where corporations are going to be in 6 months rather than where, you know, they are the economy is, you know, right now. But the fact is that because of the way the stock market is now, public corporations are massively profitable. And, you know, we have a situation, and we talk about, you know, this money isn't kept in a drawer. Actually, money is kept in a drawer. It's kept in bank accounts around the world, and not only in the United States, as we know, a lot of that money is overseas. And, you know, let's credit where it's due. President Trump is doing a good job of getting some of that money back into the U.S. But the fact is, that money is kept in a drawer, in bank accounts. You know, corporations have never held this much cash on their balance sheets than they have right now. I mean, it's a remarkable amount of money is not actually being either pushed back into corporations or into the economy by corporations, you know, either buying other corporations or indulging in capital spending. So I don't really see why, you know, Rick is that concerned about corporate profits. He's absolutely right, of course, that corporations need to make profits. Because if they don't make profits, well, they go out of business. And if they go out of business, then that, yes, indeed, is a problem for other people in the economy because, you know, 50% of the economy or 50% of the population is invested in the stock market in some way, usually through 401ks and pension plans. So, yes, it is very, very important that corporations do well. But I don't think anybody wants corporations to do badly. I think that's a real overstatement. But the other point to remember about that 50% of the population being invested in the stock market is that 50% of the population is not invested in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Right? 50% of the population has no equity in the stock market's run-up at all. So when you see the stock market doing really, really well, that's great for the people who own stock, whether indirectly or directly. But for 50% of the population, it means nothing. 50% of the people in this country couldn't care less if property prices are rising or if the stock market is rising because they don't own anything. So, you know, when we talk about the stock market and the economy, one of the big reasons that the stock market is not the economy is because even if the stock market is doing really, really well, it means that 50% of the population doesn't actually really affect them at all because they don't own anything. And if you don't own anything, then you can't benefit from the appreciation on that equity.
It is an economics explainer underway here on The Morning Show. We're in the thick of it with Patty Hirsch. He's a journalist, online host, editing the Planet Money Indicator at NPR. Do you wonder about one tiny slice of economics, or does the entire concept make you scratch your head? Did you study economics and wonder why people outside your field feel a disconnect? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Oil prices are on the rise. Italy is in political turmoil. North Korea tensions, they ebb and flow, and a trade war may be around the next corner. So how do economic principles weave together these seemingly disparate situations? We've got an economics explainer, embracing the high-low, making it accessible right here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Patty Hirsch is our trusted guide to all of this. He is a journalist and online host, editing the Planet Money Indicator at NPR, author of Man Versus Markets. Your economic questions as well, front and center at 800-642-1234. What intimidates you about understanding finance and how markets work? Join in the conversation. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Dan in Green Bay. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, good morning. Observation, the most endangered species in Washington, D.C. is a fiscal conservative. Both parties love to spend money that we don't have. They just spend it on different stuff to curry favor from different constituent groups that support them. So, and I don't know what we do about it, because if you're a politician, you know, the quickest way to get reelected is to throw money or give tax breaks or spend on projects that curry, favor from the people who like you. Maybe what England does, election reform, where they get free airtime, maybe that's get us somehow take the money out of politics, or always spend money that we don't have. Just like to hear your guest comment on that.
Thanks, Dan. Patty, go ahead.
Well, Dan's absolutely right. It's interesting to look at the. If you told Republican politicians 2 years ago that, oh yes, if this administration comes into power, then you're going to be cranking up the national debt, to amounts inconceivable. You're going to be borrowing so much money in the future to an amount that if this had been triggered during the Obama administration, you guys would have had a fit. You'd be foaming at the mouth. And here we are in a situation where we're looking at, I think somebody was saying that there was a comparison with if we borrow at the rate that we're borrowing right now for the next 5 years, we're going to have the same amount of a deficit as Italy, which is not in a particularly good situation. So, we're talking about a massive amount of debt. Yes, you're absolutely right. There's no borrowing plan that a politician ever didn't like, right? They love this stuff. And the problem is, once you've given the money away, once you've spent that money, it's really, really, really hard to give it back. Just in the same way with entitlements. It's like once you've given an entitlement, it's very, very difficult to roll that entitlement back. It's the same thing with debt. And, it would take a massive shock to the system. The type of shock that they had in Europe during the Eurozone crisis, to actually force the American government, any American government, to actually put in an austerity plan of the kind that they've seen in Europe, where they've seen these massive cuts. But we're probably not going to see that. And one of the main reasons we won't see that is because we're able to issue so much debt ourselves. It's kind of like if you're a householder. You're not able to borrow in perpetuity, right? Because you've got to find money to pay off your loans, right? You can't rack up a massive credit card debt because you've got to service that credit card balance, and you've got to find money yourself. You've got to go and earn money to actually service that credit card balance. Well, the fact is, we don't have that problem as a government, because we're able to just borrow. So if we do have a massive credit card balance, we've got to pay the interest rates on the debt that we're borrowing from, as I say, the Japanese and the Chinese, and indeed ourselves. We've got to pay those interest rates, but we just pay that by borrowing more, and we're able to do that in a way that an individual consumer is not. So I agree. It's a bizarre situation that we're in, but we're in it. And right now, until we get a government that decides to actually put some fiscal austerity in place, and one might have thought that a Republican administration would do that, but it looks like it won't.
Let's go to Carmen in Gillette. Hi, Carmen.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good, but also a little bit disenfranchised with my government, my country, and I wanted to mention about a graphic I watched on a DVD a few weeks ago. This was on a DVD called Inequity or Inequality for All, excuse me, by Robert Reich. One of the things that just burned in my memory was a picture of a graph showing middle class wages and earnings over the last 40 years. And given all the parameters, taxes, investments, ownership, etc., while in the last few years, especially CEOs' wages have skyrocketed by triple-digit percent, the author of this DVD proclaimed that middle-class wages have really gone up about 1%. So when I hear talk about, yes, a lot of people don't own anything, how can they? I guess I'm wondering what your guest take is on this graphic I saw, how accurate he feels it is or was 5 years ago when the DVD was first made versus now, or what he thinks.
Carmen, thanks. Patty, what about the middle class?
The middle class is squeezed, and it's been squeezed for the last, 20, 30 years. Carmen was referring to a video that's been produced by Robert Reich, who is the former, I think, Secretary of Labor under the Clinton administration. And he's a very thoughtful man. He produces some fairly controversial in some contexts, reports, but his data is good. And the fact is that wages in real terms have not really risen very much since 1973. I mean, that's you know, in terms when you compare it to inflation, we just do not have that earning capacity as a population. But we replace the ability to spend with our earnings with our ability to spend using debt. And this is one of the reasons that we have a massive household debt in this country. We can't save because we're not earning that much money. And we replace that ability to spend with our earnings, with our ability to borrow. So we're able to just go out and borrow. Everybody knows how easy it is to borrow, right? I mean, all those credit card solicitations that you get in the mail, you know, people, you're able to rack up huge amounts of debt, and individuals and households do rack up huge amounts of debt. So the middle class is being squeezed on two ends, right? On one side, it's being squeezed because it's not getting paid that much more. But on the second side, it's getting squeezed because it is borrowing more and it has to pay the interest on all of that debt. And a lot of the time that forces people into bankruptcy. It forces people out onto the streets. It's one of the reasons we have, you know, such a massive homelessness crisis in this country. Yeah, so there's no doubt about it. The middle class is really under the hammer. And no administration, whether it be the Obama administration or the Trump administration or the Bush administration before Obama, no administration seems to have really been able to grasp the nettle and actually find a way to deal with this slow deterioration or this slow squeeze of the middle class.
Let's go to Sayed in Brookfield. Hi, Sayed.
Good morning, Kate, and good morning to your guests. My question is about what does your guest think about, or maybe this is something that I can get educated on. As far as our economy for the past 30 to 40 years, I can see even at the global level, it shifted from production economy to almost becoming a purely financial economy, where all the corporations and their decision-making for their growth, for their expansion, even for pay scale, is pretty much hostage to how Wall Street is going to rate their value in the market. And in a way, to me, the stock, Wall Street and financial markets are kind of like owners, pretty much 100% owners of all production economy that happens. How is that going to affect really, our economies going forward and prosperity, and it really kind of like, you know, maintaining the capitalist system that really is based on consumers being able to consume what's being produced. But if there is no earnings, there is no, consuming power. If people don't have earnings to support that, how's that going to work out? And is it just going to purely become a numbers game and for big banks and big financial institutions to continue gambling like we were talking before and trying to produce money from money rather than produce money from production and a skill?
Oh, great question, Sayed. Patty, the circle there, how does that flux happen?
Well, I can understand the sense of dread that Sayed feels there. You know, that you look at what goes on in Wall Street and you see the amount of money that's sort of being funneled towards, you know, big multinational corporations. In many cases, that money goes overseas. It kind of appears to disappear. It looks really, really intimidating. But a couple of things. Firstly, the United States is still the largest manufacturing economy in the world. I mean, a lot of people say we don't make anything here anymore. That is absolutely not true. We are, I mean, depending on which way you crunch this number, you could say, well, China is now the largest manufacturing economy in the world. It depends on how you look at it. But the U.S. is still up there. This is still a country that makes things. This is not a country that, unlike some countries in the world, you know, the U.K., for example, has become almost a client state to financial services. You know, that is not the case here in the United States. It may feel that to you sometimes because of the dominance of some of these companies, but it's actually not the case. Okay, this is still a very, very healthy, diversified economy that does a lot of manufacturing. That's the first thing. The second thing is that to worry too much, and this is I'm hoping to reassure you, Sayed, here a little bit. If you think that Wall Street is growing and consuming everything, that's actually not the case. In fact, companies are actually moving away from Wall Street now. Right, you're starting to see companies in a in larger numbers than they have in quite some time, actually deciding not to have initial public offerings, actually deciding to buy their companies back from the public so that they actually, you know, own themselves as opposed to becoming ransom to Wall Street. Because, yes, it is a problem. If you're a corporate owner, and this is the way this works, if you're a corporate owner and you decide to go public, right, you decide to become part of that public system, part of Wall Street, it basically means that you're surrendering control of your company to shareholders. And that means that the shareholders then decide what it is that your company should or shouldn't do, you know, sort of guided by the board of directors. And that means then, you know, you don't have the control that you might have to do the things that you want to do. Maybe pay people more. Maybe, invest in, you know, the green economy, to do maybe positive things that you wanted to do for the economy. You can't do those things so easily if you're owned by the public and, you know, therefore to some extent owned by Wall Street. Mm. But the fact is that more and more companies don't want to do that. They want to own themselves. They want to have their own control. And I think that that is a really, really positive thing for the economy, where you have these corporations that decide to do it themselves, to go it alone, to move away from the great big financial system and actually create healthy, you know, smaller economies around the country. And I think we're seeing more of that. So I actually think we're moving in a pretty positive direction. We're moving away from this sort of overweening control by Wall Street and by the financiers. And I think we'll start to see more of that over time. And I think that's a great thing for the economy.
Patty, last hour we were talking tariffs, trade, NAFTA. What's happening in this so-called trade war with China? And how do the trade and tariff decisions affect our economy?
Well, it's difficult to know what's going on because, as with most things with this administration, it's almost impossible to know what's going on, what's happening until it actually happens. There's a lot of words right there. There's a lot of verbiage. There's a lot of news, fake and otherwise, flying around. So it's actually impossible to say what's actually going to happen until it actually happens. Mm. So we don't know yet exactly what's going to happen with our relationship with China and exactly how these tariffs are going to impact. But there's no doubt about it that once these tariffs start to clamp down, once we start charging more for things that are coming in from China and they retaliate by charging more for stuff that they buy from us, this is going to have an impact on the economy, both in terms of the microeconomies in different parts of the country where they actually produce this stuff that we're trying to sell to China. It's going to and in terms of the wider economy, where consumers are going to have to pay more for the stuff that comes from China. You know, costs are going to go up right across the board. And, you know, we could win the war, you know, if this turns into a trade war, we could win the war. And that's what the gamble is that we are going to be able to grit our teeth long enough to be able to actually muscle through this and actually come out with a very favorable trade relationship or trade advantage over China. That's the gamble. But there's going to be a lot of pain taken between now and then, and there's no guarantee that we're actually going to come out better at the end of it.
Well, we only have a few moments left. What is one more financial or economic concept, really quickly, that we haven't talked about that you could leave us with?
Well, we haven't talked about the dollar much. And, you know, a lot of people are very interested in the way the dollar is doing right now. It's actually doing very, very well. And this is this on the surface of it looks like a great thing, right? Because now we're saying, oh, this is great. The dollar is still going to remain the most important currency in the world. It's going to be the world's reserve currency. Now, I would say to a lot of people who are worried about this idea of us remaining the reserve currency, don't panic, right? This period that we're in over the last 70 years where the dollar has been the reserve currency and is the most dominant currency in the world, that is an aberration. Over time, the U.S. dollar has actually just been one of a number of currencies that are used. And I think we're going to go back to that situation.
Well, Patty,
yes, we may twin up with the U.N., but it's not going to be the end of the world.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at don't worry. Patty Hirsch, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Patty Hirsch is an editor on Planet Money's Indicator at NPR. He's worked at NPR in a marketplace. Book is Man vs. Market. Came to us with the help of NPR West. You're with us on the Ideas Network.